It is the most delicious looking item on the grocer shelves, and yet it is the item most often discarded, uneaten. This paradox of the red delicious apple leads us to ask, why did we make this apple look so good and taste so bad?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 985th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there on the slopes of Mount Fuji who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Or whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Aaron,
yes.
Are you a red delicious apple eater?
No, I'm a sweet tango apple eater.
Okay, good enough, folks. It is a broken promise of sorts. In fact, might even be considered a lie. It has such a rich red color. It stands on its own without blemish or bug. It is the most delicious looking thing on the shelves of America's grocers. Yet when one bites into the promise, one tastes only disappointment. We are talking, of course, about the paradox of the red delicious apple. We have refined an apple to be so beautiful, it commands the most prominent position on grocer shelves, and yet so tasteless, it fills the nation's garbage cans uneaten. The red delicious apple was not always so beautiful, nor so tasteless. In fact, it was once filled with taste, it became the obsession of industry, and its production industrialized to serve the world. In this process, however, producers selected for the apples that looked best, stored longer, and shipped further, and thus the red delicious became industry's apple. But wait. Those who produced apples must have tired of eating them and so neglected to select them for taste, and thus the red delicious apple lost its deliciousness. Though the red delicious apple still dominates the shelves of America's grocers, and 54 million bushels of them are sold every year, it's left uneaten in the lunchboxes of school children, on the trays of hospital patients, and in the fruit baskets of hotel receptions around the world. This paradox of the red delicious apple leads us to ask, why did we make this apple look so good and taste so bad? Here to help us graft up some answers, we have Professor Apple himself, Tom Burford, author of Apples of North America. Tom, welcome.
Greetings from the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia.
Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia. Now,
you bet. And the orchards now, some of the orchards are laden with those enticing varieties with not a red delicious in sight.
They've been banned from the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, huh?
Yeah. They're still moonshining in the mountains, but they are no red delicious.
No red delicious.
It doesn't even make good illegal moonshine, so the moonshiners tell me.
Well, it's such a beautiful apple, and it's so tasteless. It's just a mind-boggling paradox when you stop to think about it. And I often stop to think about it because, you know, when I'm checking into a hotel somewhere almost – there's a basket of fruit there, and there'll be a red delicious apple. It will look so beautiful. But I know that it will taste terrible. And so I look at that red delicious apple, and I think, I wish it was what I want it to be, but I know it isn't. So I'm just not going to touch it. And thus that apple will probably sit there for years because everybody else has come to know what it tastes like as well.
Indeed. It's probably one of the largest compost makers in the world because they are bought and there's a mindset to buy them, and then they begin to soften and rot and they are dumped. So they become at least the most that they could be good compost. So that's what they deserve, really, because it's sort of an obscenity that we have available at least 6,000 apple varieties, and this king of the apple mountain dominates, and it is fortunately changing very fast.
And you're part of the reason it's changing very fast, and for that I think everybody will come to thank you for it down the line. As author of Apples of North America, open that book, 192 beautiful apples. Oh my goodness. You just thumb your way through the book, and there's taste after taste after taste. And so 192 varieties, but you say there's 6,000. I have a really silly question for you, Tom Burford. Why didn't you put all 6,000 varieties in your book?
Well, at the age of 80, I want to save something for the next decade, so I'm sure there will be sequels.
Okay, good.
Many of them.
But isn't that really the issue that, you know, with respect to apples, they present us with so many options, 6,000 varieties, and you start crossing 6,000 varieties, and you come up with, gosh, millions of possibilities for tastes.
Absolutely, yeah. And the apple culture has disappeared. I am often referred to as the fully recycled apple guy. As I, in 1 year, approach 80 years of age, I, as a child, experienced this dynamic, exciting apple culture and watched it disappear before my eyes. And there was a regionality expressed. If I went into New England, I could get varieties that I could not grow in the Middle Atlantic. If I went to the West Coast, there were varieties growing there in California that did not grow well here in Virginia. So it was an excitement of what will I find next to have that taste discovery.
So there was a real sense of terroir, which is the expression wine growers use. We have terroir because our grapes are a deep expression of our locale, of our growing environment. And that's what we once had. You know, I would really like you to take us back to that orchard of your childhood. I have one in my childhood, too. It was on a farm up right in the lee of the Rocky Mountains, right below Yellowstone Park.
Right.
And the farm had its own orchard, fruit orchard. And among the many trees in there were apple trees and all kinds of different apples.
Yeah.
And that was your childhood. Tell us about that orchard of your childhood.
Well, my family, the Burfords, came to Virginia in 1715, and they brought apple seeds to plant. And they have been involved. I believe, have apple juice flowing in my veins. So
if not cider, right?
Sort of a family generational cultural experience as well. But when I walked out my back door on the mountain where I lived, as a child, there were more than 100 apple varieties, 40 peach varieties, dozens of cherries and plums. So I was very naive. It was a remote area, and I was very naive as a kid. I thought everybody had these. And then I discovered that was the beginning, particularly after the Second World War, when the soldiers returned to the farms and the orchards and then decided, I'm going to public works. They fled. And there we experienced one of the major reasons for what happened happening.
What was that reason?
Was that the skill of grafting. There was a generational break in how do you make an apple tree. So it this about the same time the nurseries took.
Can you hold on to that, Tom? Because I think that that skill is something I want to come back to.
Okay,
folks, sure. Knowledge is but one generation deep, and here is a perfect example of what happened when knowledge is not transmitted from one generation to the next. What happens is that we lose the variety and the spice of our life and end up with something so bereft of benefit as the red delicious apple. Wow. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about apples with Tom Burford, the professor of apples from Lynchburg, Virginia. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at metrofarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at metrofarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at metrofarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at metrofarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at metrofarm.com. That's metrofarm.com.
And so you go to the grocery store and see the beautiful display of the delicious red apples. And so you buy some and thinking, well, you know what? I'll give little Johnny an apple instead of a candy bar. So you put the apple in little Johnny's lunch bag and send him off to school. And little Johnny gets to lunchtime and there's the apple. Oh, my goodness. He bites into it and goes, yuck. And so guess what happens to the apple? It ends up where most of the other red delicious apples end up, and that's in the nation's compost pile. Is that not right, Tom Burford?
That's exactly right. And if little Johnny was smart, which many are, he would first try to trade off and get maybe a peanut butter sandwich for it. And but it's a one-shot deal, Johnny, because ever who you traded with would know next time. Yeah. Don't ever get one of these apples and try to eat it. But
I want to go back to the notion of grafting. And I think it starts with the notion that there are like 6,000 varieties of apples. They came to this young country, the United States of America, as a source of something to drink because the water was dirty. We planted orchards by the millions, and we pressed those apples into apple juice. Notice that some of the apples on the trees, hey, were pretty good to eat by themselves. And thus, thus began the whole notion of market fresh apples, right?
Well, when the railroads were primarily the first distribution system for the apples, and my family here in Virginia would send apples to Philadelphia and Washington and New York, and there was a demand by the consumer for fresh apples. And then when the beginning of the monoculture of the apple in America with Red Delicious, when the nurseries, the mega nurseries took control of the orchards, they dictated to the orchardists what to plant. And, of course, they, to begin with, reduced the number of varieties available because it simplified nursery operation. And then they simplified it even further to the number of varieties. And then they developed major marketing programs to convince the consumer that this was the best apple they could eat. And the consumer, we all gullible, and we swallowed that awful apple repeatedly until the whole culture of it disappeared, and it became an automatic mindset purchase. So
It's what's on the shelves, so it's what you buy.
Yeah.
It is what an apple is, but it really isn't at all. It's really a lie.
That's right.
Because there's so many other possibilities out there that are being withheld from the marketplace. Now, when you have 6,000 varieties of apples, each apple containing seeds, and each seed expresses a different possibility for apples.
Yeah.
So
every seed and every apple is a different variety.
And that's a lot of varieties if you come to think about it. So to get some kind of control over that whole process, what one does is look for an apple that has a favorable characteristic. It has a good taste. And how do you capture that and save it and propagate it?
You vegetatively propagate it by going to the tree or the apple you want more of and removing buds from that tree and grafting that bud to a root system, which can be grown from a simple seed. But you are interrupting what it would become by grafting to it, and then you would have, say, 10 grafts from the same tree, you would ultimately have 10 thriving producing trees of that variety. So every orchard, every tree and every orchard is grafted. And that is, that's what allowed the monoculture of the apple in America to happen, because people didn't bother to say, well, I have these wonderful apples, but and the tree is dying, but I don't know how to make another one. And one of my great joys in teaching is grafting workshops, and it is to observe these 20 or 30 or 40 people in a room who suddenly put that bud to that root system, and I say, you have made an apple tree. It is a epiphany for them. It changes their life. It gives them this authority that if I had to make a tree, I would know how to do it. So education is the pivotal point in really returning to my childhood's apple culture. Because
then would not the converse of that also be true, Tom Burford? Would not be the lack of education then the way to gain control over the marketplace to the extent that you could get away with?
Yeah, it's I deal with most of the agricultural universities both here and abroad, and there's sort of a joke among the administration of these sort of translates to hide the student. Here comes Tom Burford. And because I'm going to take them back to the rudimentary practice that they need, how they can make a tree, rather than to concentrate 2 or 3 years on studying the eye of a particular insect that feeds on the tree. And that student who, although would be highly knowledgeable with that eye of that insect, would not know the overview, would not realize that what was really involved in why there's a linkage between that insect and the tree itself. But so education, agricultural education, is rapidly changing. And they are beginning to realize, here is a student, I'm going to teach him how to specialize in orchard design or in vegetable gardening or in some practical application that produces food. And that is the bottom line, because I think subliminally and otherwise, we really are concerned about our food security. And that is why it's so important for many, many people to learn how to make that tree. Mm-hmm. You can make a tree, produce some fruit, pick that fruit, put it in your pocket, walk around for 2 weeks, take it out, and it will nourish the body. So, but that is one of the unsung things about the apple commodity as a food commodity. It could feed the hungry, really, of the world.
As it did feed a hungry young nation.
It did, because very much like the folklore of if you were in Ireland and you put your potatoes into the cellar for the winter, you could sleep soundly through the winter because you had food to eat. The same way with in the Appalachia of this area, they would store away the apples, and they would last in common storage, properly stored, until the next season produced fresh fruit. So that is rapidly changing, and
we're going to have to take a quick break, Tom Burford, but when we get back, I'd like to continue this discussion about knowledge lost and what happens when we lose our knowledge. We become vulnerable to relying on something like the red delicious apple that, though beautiful, is tasteless.
Living with strangers.
Yes, living with strangers. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, Tom Burford, and you. Which apple do you like to eat? Are you a Red Delicious fan? Let us know. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. It is the most delicious looking item on the grocery shelves, and yet it is the item most often discarded, uneaten. This paradox of the red delicious apple leads us to ask, why did we make this apple look so good and taste so bad? Well, let's pick up that story with Tom Burford, who is the author of The Apples of North America. Oh my goodness, what a delicious looking book that is. But unlike the red delicious apple, it has a lot of substance, because you can open up that book and look at the photographs of these stunningly beautiful apples, and you can almost taste them. That's a good trick. How did you pull that off, Tom?
Well, I had a very good publisher and a very good book designer and a very good photographer. So, and as a matter of fact, I spent about 6 months flying around the country collecting those apples. And it may be interesting because I like to refer to the photographs of the apples in the book as real apples. I tried to find, and if you will look closely at them, you will find blemishes.
That's what I looked at it with a friend who is an apple grower. And the first thing he knows is that, wow, these are real apples.
Because they are real apples.
Some of them have this a blister on top of them. And he says, see the blister here? That blister is to protect the apple from the sunshine.
Yeah.
And so when you see an apple without a blister, you got to ask, what protects it from the sunshine?
Yeah. And the majority of the population who are apple eaters said, I'm not going to eat that. And that is where the education factor kicks in again. When I do apple tastings around the country, I try to point out, look at this apple before I slice it up. It's pretty ugly, but wait until you taste it. And that's all. We have, for the first time in a long time, not only with the apple, but many other food commodities, we have began once again eating with our mouths and not our eyes.
Take us back to the industrialization of this red delicious, so that in looking at this industrialization, perhaps we can encourage the thoughtfulness of which you speak. The Red Delicious began, as I understand it, as a sport, correct?
Yeah, it was a seedling that appeared in Iowa in the 1870s. And The poor guy, he chopped it down twice. And finally, he allowed it to grow, and it produced this apple, which is so, if you look in the book on the Hawkeye, that is the original Red Delicious. And it does not resemble it at all. So, and it has a very good flavor, because I had one in an apple salad the other day, and I tried to feel some empathy for it, because it was so morphed and abused. There are more than 300 variations, cultivars, of that Red Delicious,
wow.
of the Red Delicious that came from that Hawkeye. And the poor thing, it was made into a Frankenstein apple.
Well, let's talk about how it became that Frankenstein, because it was offered up in an apple contest to a big nursery, and the big nursery purchased a sport or a branch from that tree, made a whole bunch of cuttings of it, grafts, I guess, and then promoted it with a budget of $750,000 way back in 1914. That was huge money then.
It was a small fortune, a big fortune, one could say.
It was a big fortune back then. So they put a huge marketing campaign, a lot of money behind this effort, and they promoted the heck out of this new apple. They called, the name eventually became the Red Delicious, and away it went. So what made it so popular?
Michael, certain other things happened along the way about the same time. There was the emergence of the soft drink industry. There was the prohibition, which really affected it. And as I said earlier, there was a flight from the farm in orchards, people started dealing, the commercial orchards, dealing with strangers, whose bottom line, they were all boardroom decisions. And also, there was a political shift from the domination by technology instead of grassroots agriculture. So all of these things were sort of the setup for the beginning of the monoculture with the Red Delicious. And then very much parallel to political challenges today. Pour the money at it and you'll be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And that indeed is what was done. So
the nursery industry encouraged apple farmers to focus on this one Red Delicious apple.
As a matter of fact, the mega nursery who started it shipped out to Oregon free trees to plant in those fertile valleys of Washington and Oregon. And it was sort of the debate that changed the whole complexion. So little by little, all of the regional, varieties disappeared, the diversity disappeared, and we were left with maybe a dozen varieties that were highly promoted and produced by a few major nurseries around the country.
So, and thus
they remedy it. Even my parents, when I was a kid, would say, and I had this passion for changing what was happening. And they said, you will not be satisfied until instead of the dozen major nurseries, you have hundreds of thousands of them throughout the country. And not only hundreds of thousands of nurseries, but a few million apple orchards. And that is what is happening now. It's all fractured. and people are discovering they're going back to the historical context, and they are finding out the cider industry, the emerging new American cider industry, is a good example.
It's a good example. Can you hold on to that, Tom? We'll pick it up when we get back from this break. Folks, apple is coming back to the United States of America. It left, but it's on its return. And thanks to people like Tom Burford and people like you who go out and find apples of taste and go, I like this apple. I think we should bring it home. And that's what we're doing. We're bringing the apple home. 831-479-1080-800-624-2665. What is your favorite apple? Are there any red delicious apple eaters out there? I want to know if somebody really does eat those things. Do stay tuned. Well, I once went down to San Antonio, Texas for a meeting of some kind or another and got to thinking, oh boy, I'm going to get in on some of that delicious Southern barbecue. But when I got to San Antonio, Texas, all I found were the same franchise food stores I found everywhere else. So dispiriting. Thus, the same is true with the apple. Wherever you go in the world, you find the red delicious. Beautiful. Absolutely stunning. And absolutely tasteless. Tom Burford, how do we get back to the place where we can travel about our country and find unique flavors, particularly suited to each little location, instead of one taste for all?
Every person who is involved needs to give their neighbor a taste of a good apple. And that's all the convincing they will need. I watch it happen regularly, and I get exclamations like, I will never buy those apples in the supermarket again. I will go to the farmer's market. I will go to the orchards that are nearby. I will encourage them. I will tell them consumer demand is making the big difference. When you go into the, and that is really what broke a trio of apples happened about the same time. And the Gala, the Fuji, and the Braeburn, and now the Honeycrisp, were introduced, and it changed from the consumer accepting what was there. They will look at it, the produce manager, and say, I sort of like these. What else do you have? So consumer demand has kicked in, and I don't think there's a turning back. There will be more and more orchards planted. There are more and more cider makers emerging. And there are more and more consumers who, rather than eat what is served on the plate, they will say, no, I will wait until I go to the orchard, or I will plant my own backyard trees. That is very much will change part of the equation as well in change. So all of these things are collectively happening, and it will make an enormous difference, particularly that consumer demand. And we are beginning to mistrust much of the food that is delivered to us by strangers. So locally, people are the locavores, the people who are going to their local, whether they be fruits or vegetables, and they are willing to pay a little more, and because they are, for the first time as well, discovering that their taste spectrums. You can take an apple, if you have a really bad day, and you come in and what you need to do, don't pop pills. Pick an apple, a good variety of apple, out of your fruit bowl. Go to a quiet place, slice it very slowly, and put it in your mouth and let the juices coat the mouth. Listen to the crunch of it, how your teeth the texture of the apple slice. And when you finish that apple, you're going to really feel much, much better. And your stress has been diminished anyway. But that is so important because I am persuaded that if we don't start eating properly and feeding our children properly, already the brain cells are affected. And that is probably what people that they say, oh, I'm overweight, I got diabetes, and I've got this heart problem. But we don't pay attention to the brain. If you don't eat properly, your brain will not function properly. And I fear that too many have gone beyond that, and they are making decisions that are not good for themselves or those around them. So eating the proper food is very important. And the fruit, especially, of course, I really like peaches as well, but apples are convenient. They can they are the perfect snack food, and they are very diverse. Everyone tastes differently. Many people, and when I do a tasting, which I'm doing in 2 weeks at Jefferson's Home Monticello, where I have close to 50 people for tasting, the first thing I will preface them with how to taste an apple. And you need to discover your taste spectrum. Some like tart apples, some like sweet apples, some like the both and everything in between. But I found with 50 people tasting, more than half of them have never thought about it. What do I like when I put cheese in my mouth? What is my taste experience? They really are beginning to, they eat for belly fullness, not the sense and the joy of the taste.
Can you hold that right now? We're going to take our last break. Oh, my goodness. Just think of it, an apple tasting with Tom Burford, the professor of apple from Lynchburg, Virginia, at Monticello. Oh, my goodness. Standing up there on the hill with a slice of apple looking out into the universe. I'm so jealous. Do stay tuned. Right back. Well, folks, a couple generations ago, we moved off the land, away from that toil of the soil, moved into town, picked up a computer desk, sat down, started moving digital bytes of information around a computer screen. Somehow we lost track of the food we ate, didn't pay much attention anymore. Put away that real stuff that we grew ourselves and our friends grew and turned to new things to eat. Things like chicken nuggets, you know, Wonder Bread, and that most beautiful of all foods, the red delicious apple. But you know, when we bite into it, when we bite into the promise, there's nothing there, not much at all. And so we end up throwing it away, or worse yet, eating it. And we're wondering, can we get back that knowledge that we lost when we moved into town? How do we do it? How do we get back there, Tom Burford? How do we get back to a place where we have that sense of terroir, where we appreciate the unique, where we start eating for our senses instead of all of our senses instead of just our eyes?
Some of us, and I pretty much closed all of my businesses in 1997 to devote the rest of my life to education, and that those who have had the experience need to share it with someone. That is, that's how we will get back to that ideal state. And you, along the way, you will be sharing harvest as well. Share your fruit. Let people experience it, and then they will want it, and then they will seek a way to find it and a way to buy it. So that is the one of the ways we are doing. It's very slow. We are now just beginning to reach back into the past and put together our what the remnants of our Apple culture of the past. And then we are at the same time inventing new Apple culture that will be very different. It will be in the electronic era of the Apples. But that we need to learn from the past as well and go back. And there are a few people out who are writing for the popular culture, and it's very receptive. People want to do it. They just don't have a roadmap. And the roadmap is to begin to let your mouth taste again. And if it's not good, don't buy it again. Find something that's wholesome and good and delectable that will give you an indelible taste memory.
And then you'll come back. And we'll be on the road. And that is the roadmap, right?
It is the roadmap. What you learn along the way, your life experiences will give you the roadmap to continue that road. And it's pretty elementary, really. But we are so bombarded today with interruptions.
Got to learn to fight back. Tom Burford, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain. To all of you who called in, sorry I couldn't get to you. I was just so greedy and so, I guess greedy is the word. I didn't want anybody else to have a moment's time with Tom Burford. Michael Olson has been The Food Chain. Thanks, Tom. Thank you all for tuning in.
Thank you, Michael, for the Apple box to spread my message.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.